What's up, everyone? This is Sarah Hudson.
And this is Evan Bogart.
And welcome to Right to the Source.
Listen, we all know creativity can be your best friend and worst enemy. On Right to the Source, we dive deep inside the minds of creative beings to find out how they do it. Today, let's find out how Harvey Mason Jr. does it.
So let it go and let's go right to the source. We create a mental atmosphere.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Tell us about our guest today.
Okay, so our guest today is Harvey Mason Jr. He's a multi-platinum selling, Grammy Award winning, and Academy Award and Golden Globe nominated music and movie producer. He's a songwriter, composer, arranger, in addition to being a music publisher and record executive. Harvey has worked with countless legendary recording artists, including Beyoncé, Destiny's Child, Justin Timberlake, Whitney Houston, Aretha Franklin, Toni Braxton, Mary J. Blige, John Legend, Babyface, and Michael Jackson. Harvey has also been instrumental in producing music for blockbuster movies such as Dreamgirls, Pitch Perfect, Straight Outta Compton, Sing, and many more. He's an incredibly talented and all-around great human being who, when he isn't in the studio, is tirelessly fighting for and protecting creators and creators' rights, working with the Recording Academy, the Grammy Foundation, and Music Cares. We're so excited to have you as our guest and to hear all about you and your creative process.
Thank
Harvey.
You. You guys are making me sound cool. I feel good about myself.
Did
right
you
now.
Love that?
did you know all of that already?
I mean, I've heard it once or twice, but you guys could follow me around when I'm feeling down and like recite that.
We can
be great.
Send you that little clip and you can just listen to it over and over.
Love it. Thank you. It's good to be here, though. I'm excited.
Awesome. Yeah, we're happy
good
to have you.
Good. Right to the source. Let's get to it.
Right. Yeah. Well, so when we start every episode, we have a segment that's called A Rose and a Thorn. We'll explain to you what that is.
Okay.
Hit it, Sarah.
Oh, and we sing our song, so.
All right.
A rose and a thorn. A rose and a thorn. A rose and a thorn.
Did you love that?
That's hot. Love it. You need to do something with that for you too.
It's an original. Okay. So a rose is basically something you're incredibly grateful for right now. And a thorn is something that's literally a thorn in your side and you need to let it go. Mm. So we'll start with a rose because gratitude should always come first. And we'll end with the thorn so we can sage it away and let it go. So let's start with everyone's rose. Harvey, do you have a rose? Or Evan, do you know your rose? Anyone who knows their rose.
My rose is, it's a bouquet of roses. It's so many roses.
Oh, I love it.
Tell us.
And it's hard for me to even talk about this subject because I feel so thankful and so, I'm glad and I'm so gracious. There's so many great things in my life, both professionally and personally. So it's really hard to pick a rose. I have amazing kids. I have a great, great family. My kids were out here visiting me for the holidays. So definitely a rose for me. I have my work. I've got some amazing projects going on. I'm so thankful to be working in this industry and making music and doing things that I've always dreamed about doing. And so many people are dying to do what I do for a living. So mm-hmm. for me, that's a huge rose, if you call it that. Mm-hmm. And just everything is good in my life. My health, I'm very, very thankful for my health.
Yes.
I'm excited to be able to do the things that I do physically every day and work out and mm-hmm. eat and just live a good life. So that's a long answer to a short question. Those are my roses.
Damn, you have a garden, bro.
Yeah. It's a beautiful bouquet.
Green thumb.
That's
yes.
right.
Amazing roses. Evan?
Mine is going to be that I had the moment to like have some time with my family and to kind of recharge. Mm. You know, we were going into the break and I was feeling really burnt and I'm feeling very rosy right now that I had this moment. I just feel very grateful that I have the ability that I didn't have to work through the holidays mm-hmm. and that I was able to take some time to kind of relax and like get perspective on my life and take stock. And I went through and like cleaned out my entire house from like garage to like gave away I gave away like an entire closet full of clothes to like donations and to like the poor. And like, I mean, really just, it was an amazing, amazing few weeks.
That's a hot rose.
Hot rose.
I think my rose right now is my meditation practice. I have, you know, suffered from anxiety a lot in my life. And, yeah, always literally been to psychics, shamans, healers, all of it. I mean, I've just therapists, like I've just, you know, done the whole runaround, but there's just something about meditation and the specific practice that I narrowed it down to that just is like the only thing that really centers my mind and just calms me down and really reminds me to connect with, you know, what I call God. And yeah, I've been really making sure, especially in this new year, that I've been doing it every single morning with no phone beforehand, like nothing, just really connecting to myself. And I just am grateful for it. Every time I sit down to do it, I'm like, oh, it feels so good.
You've been doing no phone mornings, right?
Yes, I've been doing no phone mornings, which is basically airplane mode before you go to bed. Wake up. I do my meditation, walk my dogs, have my coffee, have a shower, like do a whole morning, then off airplane mode. And it's only been 4 days, but it's been fucking amazing.
And like, you don't feel like anxiety, like you're missing out on anything.
I did actually today. The first few days I was like, oh, I love this. And then today I was like I wanted to look, but I was like, no, I'm going to do. And then as soon as I calmed my mind and like quieted my mind.
What about it is the thing you miss the most?
I don't think it's that I miss anything. I think I'm just literally addicted to it. Like I think
as we all are, I think.
Yeah.
Can I say like if I'm in like a anywhere, like a movie theater, a meeting, anywhere, if I literally catch myself putting my hand in my pocket to grab my phone,
I know
I'll be having a full-on conversation, looking someone in the eye, talking to them, and my right hand will just start reaching into my pocket. Like,
I know.
Like you're not even going to look at your phone. Like it's just like on automatic.
Second nature.
It's so weird.
What's really crazy is when I went to Hoffman, I went to this basically spiritual retreat type of thing for 8 days, and they take your phone. So you don't have your phone or computer for Whoa. 8 days. And literally the first day without it, it was such an instinct to be like, where's my phone?
Right.
Or like in your
always.
Pocket. Or
you left it somewhere.
Or some people said they felt it like vibrating.
I've definitely felt that in your pocket. You just feel like it, but it's not in your pocket.
It's so freaky.
Oh my God, phantom phone.
Phantom phone syndrome.
You know, the vitamin water company is paying somebody $100,000 to see if they can go 1 year without their phone. And they're doing this as an advertising campaign.
What?
I think they're selecting people at random to pay them $100,000 to see if they can go without their phone for a year. They're giving you a flip phone and they're taking your cell phone.
I would actually gladly do it.
$100,000, sign up.
I wouldn't even do it for that. I mean, I guess that would be a reason
year,
to do it.
A year, though? That's a lot. But I guess you could be on your computer.
Laptop. I use my laptop for it.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And a flip phone.
Yeah.
And a flip phone. I mean, that's not that bad.
I'm not going to do it, but somebody will.
When I was away for the holidays, I went, I was on a boat one day and I decided to leave my phone back at the room because there were so many people going. I was like, someone else is going to film if anything cool happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to look at my phone. I want to enjoy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Love that.
The moment.
Those are always great things
and
to
I
do.
And I thought to myself, like, at the end of my life, this is a moment. Today will be a moment that I'll look back on fondly and be like, this is such an enjoyable part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you know what? We saw, like, whales and dolphins. Like, it was crazy. It was, like, the most insane day, and I didn't have my phone.
That's great. You have it in your mind, though. You'll remember mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, other people filmed.
Yeah.
They shared their videos with me.
Well, then exactly. You have the best of both worlds.
Yeah, exactly. But I did have it in my mind. I had the moment of me experiencing it instead of experiencing it holding a phone.
Well, right. Do you ever go to a concert and like, it just bums me out so bad. They're not even watching the concert. They're filming.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as they capture an image, they're in their phone trying to transmit it or post it.
And they miss the next
while
scene.
The concert's still going on.
It's crazy.
I'm like, what's happening here?
I know. It's
out
like,
of control.
Why is that? That's so weird.
They want to share and they want people to know what they're doing. Yeah. They're at a concert. Hey, I'm at a festival.
They want to look like they're doing something cool.
Right.
To what end?
Attract attention.
And validation. Yeah. And like, oh, you're so cool. You're there. Oh, wow, wow. It makes you feel good. It's adrenaline. Or what do they call it? Serotonin or whatever.
Kind of why people post mostly, right?
It's dopamine. Yeah. It's a rush.
Yeah.
That would be.
Yeah, it is why people post anyway.
That would be a dope artist name for you.
Dopamine.
No, serotonin.
Oh, yeah. True. That is.
When you said that, I was like, that's your rap name.
Serotonin.
That's your rap name.
I like it.
Okay, so let's move on to our thorns.
Yeah. So you have so many roses. Do you have any thorns?
I don't. I don't feel like there's anything nagging at me right now. I really don't have anything negative in my life. I don't have anything weighing me down. Everything feels really positive and upbeat to me right now. I have a couple projects that are long, arduous projects.
Thorny.
That need work, but I love that. That's kind of part of my rose.
What about any like worldly thorns? Like is anything, you have any particular issue?
Other than Trump?
Other than Trump, yes.
Because that's like such a
given. Obviously, he's just a walking thorn.
Thorn. you know, that's a deep question.
I know it is a deep question, but I thought I would just throw it out there.
No, I feel like very fortunate personally. I know there's a lot of other people that aren't as fortunate as me, so I guess that would be a thorn that everybody's not happy and healthy and able to provide for themselves, which I would wish they all could. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I guess world peace seems a little overreaching, but I would like to see people in our country at least be happy and healthy and be able to care for their basic needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So, like the less fortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think we're all fortunate. The three of us in the room, we've all accomplished absolutely. Things, been able to take care of ourselves and hopefully other people. But, you know, there's mm-hmm. so many people that have not, even within our music business. You
absolutely.
Know, there's people that are just struggling. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I guess that would be a thorn.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that.
My thorn. I cannot get over I don't know what it is. I have a fear of public speaking.
Interesting.
Since when? I've always seen you speak publicly.
And I'm shit scared every time I do it.
You kill it.
Well, you do well, so it doesn't matter.
I know.
That can't be your thorn. You're too good at that.
No. It's my thorn because I wish I had more confidence about it. Like afterwards, I'm always like, man, that was really like you did okay. Like there was nothing for you to be like weird and nervous about. But like beforehand, I can't sleep the night before. Like I literally cannot sleep the night before. This last week was I took a chip for my for 14 years of being sober, and
congratulations.
Thank you.
And that's amazing.
Literally for like an entire week leading up to it, I just kept like obsessing of like I have to take a chip and I have to take a cake because I owe that to myself and I owe that to the newcomers. You know, I had to speak to them and tell them how I did it. This is what the program is. But I just was freaking out. Like, I can't believe I have to stand up there in front of people. I go to this meeting like 5 days a week. I've known these people for years.
Uh-huh.
There shouldn't be anything uncomfortable about it. And right. The night before, I sat there and like wrote down points that I wanted to hit in my speech. It was so stupid. But like, it makes me feel more comfortable. And yet I woke up at 2:30 a.m. and couldn't go back to bed and tossed and turned the whole night. And it's like, why? It's like, I have a speech coming up that I need to make in April and I'm already worried about it now. I don't know. That's my thorn. I got to figure it out.
Yeah, you have to figure out what's underneath the...
The fear.
The fear.
Yeah. I think Hoffman would knock that out of me.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's a great place. Okay, so my thorn... I think my thorn is just right now, I tweaked my neck like a few months ago, and it's just been like getting worse over like a few months. And over the holidays, I just was doing everything, chiropractor, acupuncture, body work, like cupping. I mean, everything. And it's just still, it's literally like a thorn in my neck.
Does cupping hurt?
Cupping is, it just feels so good. I love it. It's just like,
wow. Looks like it hurts.
It looks like, doesn't it? It's like,
it's kind of just feels like, you know, a massage. It feels just like it's.
That's like really old school, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
When I say old school, like
medicine, like
600s or something.
And how did you hurt your neck?
That's the thing is, I don't know. But
you slept on it or something.
Well, this whole past year, I have traveled the most I've ever traveled in my life in 1 year, and eating like kind of like shit, not exercising. I just was just not all bad. So I'm kind of thinking I'm attributing it to my lifestyle, and maybe it was on a plane, maybe it was sleeping. I don't know, but it's just been really annoying, and you know, it's a thorn. That's what it is.
Got to get it out of there.
I'm trying, you know. So that's my thorn.
So your neck is your thorn?
My pain in the neck. My pain in the neck.
Literal pain in the neck.
Literal thorn in the neck.
A thorn in the neck.
Yeah.
So Harvey's is the underprivileged.
Yes.
The less fortunate people in the world.
Yes, that's an amazing
Yours word. Is a literal pain in the neck.
Yes.
Or whatever emotions are leading to having a little pain in the neck, maybe. Maybe it's emotional. Maybe you're holding on to something. Whatever the baggage.
Yeah.
So physical, emotional, whatever the baggage that's giving you a pain in the neck.
Yes.
The less fortunate that keep Harvey up at night. And for me.
Your fear of public
speaking. Just fear. I think it's just fear. I think it's silly fear. Just fear.
Yeah, that's a thorn always.
Let's sage this away, yeah?
Okay, so we're going to sage away these thorns. And let them all go. Evan is lighting white sage. Do you sage, Harvey, ever?
No, I don't, but I'm checking this out now to see what's going on here.
And here we go. We're letting all of our thorns go. Feels good, better, right?
Yes. It does.
Even just that sound, just, let's let them go. Here you go. Okay. So let's dive into the good stuff. So Harvey, when do you first remember being creative in your life? Like, even if it's a song you sang when you were three or like a painting.
Yeah, I think it was really early. All of the things that you just said, I was doing at a very young age. I was painting. I was taking piano lessons from the time I was five. Before that, I think the first thing I remember being creative is having a piano in my family home and always sitting down on the piano trying to figure out how to make music. And when I was, I think, one or two, my dad was doing pitch matching exercises with me on the piano. So I would always, when I could just walk, I would reach up and find the piano and try and find the note that he was whistling. And I started that. I was definitely one, because I just was barely able to walk. So I've been creative my whole life and loving it the whole time.
And was anyone in your family musical, creative?
Yep. My mom and my dad were both musicians.
Okay.
So I grew up in a musical household. They both played instruments and they both wrote music. So I was around it my whole life.
Because I was too. I grew up in it. My father's a record producer, writer, my mom's dancer, just my whole family. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of just a no-brainer for me that's what I was going to do. Like, I always say, if I said to my parents, like, I want to be a lawyer, they'd be like, what? You know, like, was it like that for you? Was it something that was just natural? You were like, oh, this is it.
It wasn't. I actually wanted to be an athlete. I grew up playing sports, and I was a jock, you know, my whole childhood.
Okay.
I played every sport, basketball, football, baseball. And then in high school, I got really good at basketball. And so for me, music was a hobby. It was just a distraction, a pleasant distraction, something that I used when things weren't going well in sports or in school, and I would write songs, or when I was thinking about a girl or whatever the case was. I used music as a sideline.
Wow.
And my main focus was always sports all the way up through college. I loved music, and I continued to take piano lessons, and I was always writing songs and writing music. But that really wasn't the no-brainer for me. It was always sports.
Huh.
When did you first write a song?
I was probably 5 or 6 when I started writing songs.
Well, do you remember the title?
No, but I know the first song I ever got published, I was 8 years old, and it was called Love Makes It Better by an artist called Grover Washington Jr.
Wait,
what?
Stop.
You
wrote
8?
A song for Grover Washington Jr. and you were 8?
Yeah, I did. My dad was playing drums on his record. And I'd been writing songs, you know, for a couple of years at that point. And for me, they were just like chord progressions. And my dad heard, he's like, that's really cool. Let me mess with it. And he kind of like messed around and took it in to the session that day. That's back in the day when the musicians would sit around and like jam on like riffs and things. And so they started playing my thing, and Grover's like, oh, I like that. Let's do this and do that. And they recorded it. So that was my first placement.
That is so legendary at 8 years old.
It's crazy.
That's
right?
Amazing.
But you didn't know at that point, like, well, obviously because you went and you wanted to play basketball, but like, was there any point before you were playing basketball in high school that you thought, I'm going to make music my career?
No, no. It was fun. I loved it. And I didn't really even put two and two together that that was an option. My dad was a drummer, and he was really good at his instrument, and like that's how he made a living, was playing drums. And I was like, man, he's amazing. I'm not that great at any one particular instrument. So for me, it was writing songs was just a cool way to express myself and a cool way to have something that was really fun outside of schoolwork and basketball.
But as a drummer, were you a better songwriter than him? Like he was a drummer. He
was a
writing?
Drummer, but he was also a songwriter and also a producer. So, I wasn't as good as him when I was young. I wanted to be, but it just didn't seem like that was my path. I knew I would always love music and I would always be involved in it, but that was kind of my dad's thing and my mom's thing. And I played drums as a kid. I took piano lessons. I did it all. I grew up in the studio with my dad, but I was really focused on sports.
So you're in high school and you're playing sports, right? And then do you move into sports professionally?
I'll tell you exactly how I got to sports and then how that led me to music.
Okay.
In high school, I was recruited to play basketball, so I ended up going to University of Arizona to play basketball. Had a cool career there for 4 years. My senior year, I tore my ACL in my knee.
Oh,
and that was a career-ending injury for me at that point, and especially being a senior, because you can't really fix it and come back and play more and prove yourself. So I had the surgery repair my knee, and as I was recuperating and recovering, I just had my piano and my keyboard and a computer, and I started programming and making music and making tracks. Just I was going to be indoors and in a cast for 3 months, so I just started tracking and writing music. So once I did that, my girlfriend, who ended up being my wife at the time, was a creative director at an ad agency. And she needed some music for a bus company. They're like, let's do a jingle for this bus company. And she said, oh, my boyfriend makes music. So I did a bus jingle. And so that was really my second, after the Grover Washington Jr. thing, my second like paid music opportunity. I think they gave me $1,500 to write them a jingle.
Amazing.
So I did that. And then I finished college and I just started writing a ton of jingles. And I was writing 60-second, 30-second spots for everybody that I could meet, you know, soda company, a break store, a taco joint, whatever it was, I was writing jingles and built up a pretty good jingle business for about 2 or 3 years, where we were doing local spots, regional spots, and then we started doing Coca-Cola and Mattel toys. And I loved it because I could use all my experience as a songwriter and as a guy who just loved music to do tons of different genres of music. Sometimes it was rock, sometimes it was country, sometimes it was like a corny kids rhyming song for a Barbie doll. Whatever it was, I was able to do it in 30 or 60 second increments. So I loved that.
That's amazing. So that's and really, get paid.
Right, and get paid.
How cool is that?
So that's how I started.
Is there something that's like, is there something that feels almost like a, like, I don't know if a relief is the right word, but like something that feels like, I don't know, it's just, there's something about writing a 30 second, 60 second jingle that, that takes the pressure off at the same time and just like cuts out the fat. You're just like, I'm trying to write the hookiest thing ever.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's no real story. I don't have to tell like this like 3.5 minute story and there's not to be a bridge. And it's like, it kind of takes like this. You're like, I'm going to go in there just for the kill. What's the catchiest thing I could write right now? How do I sell this product?
Right. And that was the goal. And that was, I think, it came from my experience from writing songs my whole life of doing exactly what you said. You got to lay it out. You got to tell the story. You got to set it up. And then you got to drop in a chorus. Whereas in a jingle, you're like, you're not worried about any of that. You're getting most of the information from the client. Okay, you have to say it's $39 for a break change. You have to say that we're open these hours. Now, what are you going to sell and what are you going to say to make the listener pay attention and remember it? And so that's kind of where I used my experience in writing hooks is to writing jingles, real memorable parts.
I want to go back one second to, okay, so you're playing basketball for Arizona. You downplayed the fact that you were in a Final Four team with a lot of really awesome basketball players.
Yeah, again, very lucky.
Yeah, you're in the hospital. You're recovering. Is there this moment of like, I mean, you're not making music because you're making music because you're bored, or is there a moment of like, is there a God shot? Is there like something that like speaks to you, or that you're like, you know what, I may never play basketball again, and I'm being drawn to this, or was it just kind of like out of pure
hobby,
like boredom?
It was neither bored. It definitely wasn't boredom. It was, I knew I had other loves in my life other than sports, and music was one of them. Mm-hmm. And when I found out and when I realized that I wasn't going to be able to pursue my dream of playing basketball, and this sounds horrible, but my next passion was music. Mm. And so I said, okay, basketball's over. I don't want to be a lawyer or, you know, a doctor. I want to make music. I want to be creative. So it was almost just an evolution or the next step in the things that I wanted to do. I went to college, and my focus in college was political science and English as a minor. And so I had like had a three-tiered plan. I was like, wow. Okay, I'm going to play sports. I'm going to make music. I'll go to law school or be in politics.
Wow.
So that was kind of the things that I wanted to do. So when I hurt my knee, I said, okay, that's over. Let's focus on music. And I put all my energy, all my focus. Every time that I would spend playing sports or training or lifting weights or running, I'd spent making music. Very competitive for me.
And you knew at that time that it was going to be your
yes
job in your life. Like that was the first moment you were like, okay, this is going to, I'm pursuing yep this as yeah my job. Right.
So, and then back to Jingles, did you think like at the time that you were killing it doing Jingles, were you like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be the jingle guy.
No, never. The jingle guy was just a means to an end.
Yeah.
I was trying to make money so I could buy equipment. Mm-hmm. I think one of my first jingles, I made like $1,500 or something. So I bought a keyboard. Then the next one, I make a couple hundred dollars more. I buy a little better microphone. I just used that money to support my music writing mm-hmm habit, which was trying to make the best records I could make. Mm-hmm. And I knew at this time I was also living in Tucson, Arizona, you have to remember. So mm I was trying to find people to collaborate with on the songwriting side and
right
trying to find people who had made records before in my neighborhood, but there were none of those. So mm it was me listening to the radio, listening to CDs and studying how music was made, and then trying to buy equipment that I really didn't know what to do with mm-hmm and get my hands on it so that I could figure out how to make my songs sound like what I was hearing on the radio. So the jingles were just a little bit of a means to an end for me to make money and buy my equipment.
And then from how did it go from the jingles and building up your equipment and to going into music and songs and working with artists?
Yeah, the whole time I was doing jingles, I was always writing music, and okay I was always trying to find collaborators, as I said, and artists in Arizona. And like, if I found a rapper in Arizona, I'd be like, hey, let me make a track for you. Or if
right
there was a singer I met backstage at a Jodeci concert, I'd say, hey, I do R&B music. Let mm me make some music for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I was recording a ton of demos. My sister was a singer. I had a guy who I worked with who was another singer, aspiring artist. So I was always just recording demos.
Was your family in Arizona too?
No. At
they
that
were
point
here?
At that point, I was only, you know, 20, 21 years old. My mom and dad still lived here in L.A.
Mm.
I just finished college in Arizona, so I was still trying to figure out what I was going to do. I was doing jingles. The money I was making, I was buying equipment, but I was also flying to L.A. to try and pitch my demos to A&R guys. And I would drive out if I didn't have enough money, or I'd fly out if I had some money. Sometimes I'd stay with my dad if he was in town. If he wasn't, then I was staying at friends' houses, but bringing cassette tapes of my songs and
wow
like literally
what are those
pitching. I know, it's crazy,
just
right?
Just hustling.
Just hustling.
Yep.
And I was going to record labels and sitting outside. Now it's easy, kids email, but mm-hmm back then it was like you had to find the A&R guy.
Totally,
and
I
then
remember.
I'd follow them home. I'd put stuff in their mailbox. One guy had a convertible, Ron Sweeney. I used to throw cassettes in his convertible all the time. I mean, I did all the craziness. Backstage concerts was a great place to meet people and A&R uh-huh people, clubs and perform. So I did all that. Meanwhile, I'm still doing the jingles in Arizona, driving back and forth to LA to Arizona, trying to play songs. And to your question, what tipped the scale, one person heard a song of mine from Motown Records, and he said, it's good, but it's not quite good enough. Come to my office and I'll meet with you. He didn't know I didn't live in LA.
Do you know how he heard it?
I sent it to him.
Okay.
He was actually related to Ron Sweeney, who I had been stalking for like 6 months.
Okay.
Who lived right on like near Vine and I don't know the cross street, but I could show you his house. It was this huge house. I used to sit outside his gate all the time.
Right.
So Ron ultimately connected me to this guy. His name was Guy Abrahams, and he was an A&R at Motown Records. He heard some of my music and said, it's close, but it's not great. Come to my office. So I was like, oh, geez, I got to drive back to L.A. So I drove to L.A.
Wow.
Sat with him, and he played my cassette, which he had somehow. And then he played me a cassette of his artist. At the time, it was a guy named Joe, J-O-E. I don't remember Joe, but he was a really cool R&B artist.
Like
back
JoJo?
Then. Yeah,
oh, Joe.
Joe.
Yeah.
He was on Motown back when it was his first record.
Wow.
And so guy played my cassette and said, that sounds pretty good. I was like, yeah, it sounds really good, really good. And then he said, listen to this. And he played Joe's record. It was before Joe came out. And he said, you hear how good that is? I said, yeah, that's amazing. He said, well, yours doesn't sound that good, right? I said, no, it doesn't. He said, until yours sounds as good as his, don't call me back.
That's dope, though, that he did that.
Did he give you the Joe cassette?
Yeah.
To take with you?
He did.
Got it. Okay.
And he said, when yours sounds as good as that, then call me. Other than that, just don't come back. And so amazing. I went back to Arizona with this cassette, and I just studied and studied and listened, and I replicated the drum sounds. I came, like, figure out what the bass lines were, and then I started integrating that into my music, into my songs, and the stuff that I learned from Guy and the cassette he gave me, I started putting in every song. I said, well, and I told him when I was in his office, I said, well, you know, I don't have all that equipment and I don't have all that expertise and knowledge, but I just make songs. He said, well, that's the point. Mm-hmm. You have the songs, but you don't have any expertise and knowledge. I'm not going to give it to you. I'm not going to just take your song because it's a nice song. It has to sound amazing. And the quality of the song has to be right. The vocal has to be right. The drum, everything's got to be right.
Right.
It's a whole package. So I tried to give him all the excuses under the sun, but he wasn't going for it, which is really important because I really subscribe to that philosophy. There are no excuses. Like, you have to figure it out.
Yeah.
You can't just say, oh, well, it's the best I've got. That's not going to work. It's not good enough. So when I went back to Arizona, I had no idea how to get my drums to sound heavy on the kick like that or my snares to crack like that. I had no clue. So I would go to the music stores in Tucson and I would pull up, you know how they let you play the keyboards by them for free, like you can do it all day. I would go there for 6-8 hours and try every keyboard until I found the ones with the right drum sounds. Then I would say, what is this compressor do? Let me figure out how to work this compressor. Let me see, what does this EQ do to the sound? I would try it all at the music store. And then when I got my next check, I'd buy something that I liked.
Right.
So that's how I got my music to sound.
That's kind of genius.
Like that next level.
Totally. And yeah. I feel like that was such a mentor moment of that guy saying that to you,
I thank him every time. He's the one who changed the path of my career.
I just love the ingenuity of going to the music store and literally just trying everything until you found the sounds they used on the Joe record.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's what I did.
I love that.
Yeah.
So
I'd be, then, like, I'd be like now when you're going through like soft, you know, like.
Yeah, you'd be online just scrolling through sounds. Like, what did Zed use for that break?
So when did you get to, did you come to LA?
After I went back to Arizona, I worked really hard for about 6 months. And then I came back and I contacted Guy Abrahams from Motown. And I said, I think I've got it. I played him a new song. He said, way better, incredible, I'm impressed. And he hired me to do a remix for a group he had on Motown. They were called Impromptu, which is a crazy name. But anyways, I did a remix for them. I did another remix for them. And then they were starting their new record, and I did a song for Impromptu. And he paid me, I think, $3,000 for the song. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is better than jingles.
You're like, I made it.
This is what I want to do for my career. This is what I want to do for a living.
Amazing.
So that was my first real kind of like, production check.
Nice.
When you were trying to figure all that out, though, did you ever feel like, I mean, I know your philosophy is that there is no. I mean, there's no way that you can't figure it out. Mm-hmm. You have to figure it out. But were there any moments where you felt like, man, this is too hard?
No, not at all. Not at all. You have to remember too, you guys, I came up in a sports background. So there was never a this is too hard situation because we got our tails kicked right. every day by our coaches and our strength conditioning team and dietitians. I mean, we were crazy. And mm-hmm. playing college sports, it's not easy and it's not light work. So when I finished with that, everything else was very easy.
Did you feel competitive?
Super competitive.
And in music, I mean, when you
very
started?
Very competitive in music, and I still am.
But same. I feel the same.
But you almost didn't know who you were being competitive against. I mean, I feel like the first time you heard the Joe cassette was kind of like the first introduction to the fact that things sound better.
You want to know what that was like? And this is another parallel for you. That was like when I was in high school, I played basketball. I was All-American in high school, but I got recruited to go to Arizona. And I went to Arizona. And I thought I was great. And I thought I was really, really good because I had my bubble in my high school and in my area.
Right.
I was really good. When I got to Arizona, there was a guy on my team who was there before me named Steve Kerr. And I used to watch him shoot at night after study table, and I watched him shoot the first night. I'll never forget it. He didn't miss a shot for about 30 minutes, and I I was like, whoa, I thought I was really good. But once I got exposed to other great players, I said, oh, I've got to like totally restructure my whole game plan. And it's the exact same thing that happened with the Joe record. When I heard that record, I thought I was making great music. I was excited. I was proud. I was pitching my cassettes. But when I heard that, I was like, oh, I have to step my whole game up.
Right.
I got to go back. I got to rethink about how I'm going to make this music. So to your point, Evan, it wasn't hard. It was just like thinking about it and trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to beat that?
What? So you applied your kind of mental toughness from sports. You applied that to your music.
I applied everything I learned in sports from a couple of really key people. My coach in college was a guy named Lute Olson, who's definitely one of my mentors. So a lot of things that I learned from him as far as work ethic and persistence and perseverance, and also setting the bar for yourself higher than you think you should or higher than you think you can reach. I learned a lot from him, and it sounds weird to say about a teammate, but I learned a lot from my teammate, Steve Kerr, who was really similar to Coach Olson. He just had a high standard, high ethics, quality guy, and just really had a crazy, crazy worker, like a way about him that just worked. And so between those guys and then my dad, I just learned that you have to have a passion, you have to have a focus and a dedication, but then you got to go for it and you got to grind it out. So yes, I'm very competitive. I still am to this day. And the way I approach my music is very similar to sports. I'm always trying to keep my team pushing hard and trying to get to the next level, trying to set goals, trying to accomplish great things. And it's all based on work for me, for sure.
Damn, what a squad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lute, Steve, and your dad?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And then, and then add to the fact that I got a really nice opportunity to get to know Quincy Jones really well. And so those are really my guys, Lute and Quincy and Steve and my dad. And those are the people that I looked up to and respected and learned a lot from.
That's amazing. So from Impromptu, where do we go from there? Is it just...
It's me writing a ton of songs, me doing every session I can get my hands on. And the music business was so different than you guys. And it was not about just like booking a bunch of random writing sessions and pitching songs. It was going into the studio with artists, trying to create, trying to make great art, great music. So after Impromptu, I did a couple other Motown artists. And then I started... I somehow got hooked up with an artist from the UK named Michelle Gale. She was making music for MCA over in the UK. And her A&R person heard some of my music and loved what I was writing. He had a publishing company. So he said, I want to sign your publishing. And same thing for me. I'm like, okay, this makes sense. It's probably a horrible deal, which it was. But it's a stepping stone for me. I need to get to the next place.
Right.
I want. He was offering me $25,000 for my publishing, 10-song MDRC.
My gosh.
And I desperately needed an MPC 60 and a Kurzweil K2000. Those were going to be about $15,000 by the time I got the hard drives and all the stuff I needed, floppy disk drive and the wiring. So just very analytically, I just said, okay, I'm going to give this guy my publishing. He's going to give me $25,000. I'm going to go buy the equipment I need, and I'm going to upgrade my songwriting, my production to a whole nother level, and I'm going to make that money back in no time. So that was the goal. It took me 5 years to get through the first term of my delivery commitment.
I mean, I think we've all been
there. We've all done it, right? We've all done it. But I got my $25,000, and I worked my way through that delivery commitment. And one of the first things I did after I got my equipment was started writing with another writer, and we wrote a song that Brandy heard, and she had just come off the heels of her first big record. I think she sold 7 or 8 million records, and we wrote a song that she really liked, and I think that was where you were heading. How did I get from there to here?
Right.
It was the Brandy song that she heard and that she loved and was on the Never Say Never record.
And so that, did that feel kind of like a moment like, okay. You know, I mean, I know you were building, but was there ever a moment that was like, all right, not an I've made it moment, but a moment where you're like, okay, I'm on a trajectory and like, I feel it just opening, the door opening.
Definitely. I think there were a few critical points for me. The Impromptu song and remix was where I felt like, oh, wow, I'm really in a cool place. I'm in a great direction. Because it was my first experience going into a real studio on my own, not with my dad or not with a project that, you know, my dad was working on. So I was in a studio. So that was a big moment. The Brandy moment was definitely a big moment because I was working with A-level artists finally for the first time.
Right.
And just in the room with presidents of labels and Brandy and her other musicians and other producers that were working on that record. At the time, it was Rodney Jerkins who was A&R and kind of like quarterbacking that album. So being in the presence of those people definitely made me feel like I was going somewhere kind of positive.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love that.
Brandy led to other great opportunities and producing really cool songs. In that same year, I started working with Rodney Jerkins, and we started working on Destiny's Child and Toni Braxton and Brittany. I mean, all the crazy artists, and we had a crazy run.
With Rodney, you worked closely?
Yeah, cool. For 2 years.
And so, are you producing and writing?
Writing, producing, engineering, Pro Tools, doing vocal, everything. I'm doing everything I can get my hands on.
Every project you get to, up to Brandy, then in with Rodney, new people you're meeting, you're going into new rooms. Do you keep finding this situation where you're like, oh my God, I need to step my stuff up?
Yeah.
Like
every time.
Because I feel like every single project you named, this progression, now you're into the legends, right? Now you're working with legends to produce and write for legends.
Right.
And you're probably walking into a room every time going like, I got this. Yep. And then you're in the room and you listen to like Brandy sing something you're like, oh my God, these harmonies, like whatever. Right. You know, it's like,
I feel like, does that ever go away? You know, wanting to step up your game?
No, not really. But I think for me, I did enter each of the opportunities with a lot of confidence because I feel really comfortable with what I do and who I am. But I don't necessarily look at it as step your game up, but I learn a lot from each experience. Mm-hmm. And yes, working with Rodney was amazing. Learned a ton of great things from him. The artists that we worked with, you know, Destiny's Child, and learned a lot working in that environment, to Toni Braxton. The last project I did with Rodney was a Michael Jackson record. And then that takes us to getting into TV and film and music for visuals. All the music and all the records that I made, including Michael and everybody else, would take me to the opportunity where I could make music for film, because that's a whole different set of issues and a whole different circumstance and different process in the way you make music. And a lot of what I learned enabled me to be able to do that.
And is that like scoring films? Or?
It's a little of everything. It's scoring films. It's producing songs for films. It's producing musicals and, like you said, live action musicals.
What kind of musicals? Like movies or like Broadway stuff?
Both, but I've kind of done them all. I've done the Broadway thing. I've done live action musicals for NBC. We did The Wiz. I did Jesus Christ Superstar. I worked on Hairspray. Now we're starting another one called Hair for NBC. So I've done those.
Hairspray
for NBC.
Oh, for NBC.
Yeah.
And then what on Broadway? Because I'm like a Broadway geek. So,
I'm doing a musical now. We're working on developing it. It's from a film that we've now turned into a musical called Pursuit of Happiness, which is really, really cool. So that's exciting. I worked on The Color Purple a little bit. I think those are the two things that come to mind.
How did you make that jump, and why did you make that jump? Was it like, because like after Michael, obviously you've gone on and written and produced for a ton of different artists, and also you signed and developed writers and producers and artists, and you became a mentor yourself, and so you wore the hat, you know, that a lot of other people have been wearing with you.
Right.
And then you also... Now the film and TV and live action musicals are such a huge part of your career now, but you know, at some point they weren't probably the focus, right? Like,
no, was not it, at all.
Were your songs ending up in a lot of, were you getting synced a lot? Is that how that made that jump?
No, you know, we made the jump because I saw a little bit of the future of what was happening with songwriting and producing, and I wanted to diversify into other things. And I also wanted new challenges, you know. After Michael and Rodney, then I started Underdog Entertainment. And so we had, as you said, a label and a publishing company. We signed a ton of writers and producers, and we were doing hundreds of songs a year. And then it got to the point where people were starting to try and just cookie cutter records and trying to like make a record like you did this artist and do this song. And so we did get a little bit of like, that's not as fun for us anymore. And we continued to do it. And like I said, we had writers cranking out songs, but I saw a new opportunity in the film space, and it was presented in the form of Dreamgirls, which is the first real film musical that I did. Before that, we had definitely had songs placed and synced in films and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. Dreamgirls was in 2006, and it was at Paramount Studios, and they were looking for a producer to come in and be able to produce the songs in a contemporary way, but somebody who still was really musical and knew instrumentation and knew authentic instruments and musicians, and to kind of blend the two together. So we got hired to produce that film, and it was about 50 or 60 songs or pieces of music in that film. So it was a ton of work. It was a year-long project. But that was my introduction to the film stuff. And I said, this is really something that I want to pay attention to and focus on. Mm. It's a new challenge. There's a lot of different styles of music. It's not making the same old thing over and over and over again. And so in 2007, right around there, I really started focusing on trying to do more film and TV projects.
That's cool. You mentioned Quincy Jones being sort of a mentor to you. And, you know, how did that come about? What was that like for you?
It's been amazing. And I still keep in touch with him and speak to him from time to time. But my dad would play on records for Quincy back in the day. So that's how I originally met him. And then as I started working more and becoming a little bit more successful, he reached out, or I reached out, and he just said, come up to the house, let's talk. And so I would spend some time talking to him and just asking questions. And then when I did The Wiz, I know he had done The Wiz, the film.
Wow.
So when I was doing The Wiz, I like went up and I asked his permission, and I asked, you know, respectfully if he was going to be okay for me to work on this. And he said, of course. He said, come to the house and let's talk about all. I'll give you my old stories about when we did it originally. And
wow.
So just things
so cool.
like that. Yeah. Having him to be able to bounce ideas off of and ask his opinion of things. And he's just a guy that I really look up to, who's done it all.
Yeah.
He's done it at a really high level. He's really done things that I've always wanted to do. He went from music to arranging to playing to writing records to mm-hmm. doing film and TV to producing film and TV to building companies. So mm-hmm. he's somebody that I definitely, definitely like to model myself after.
And he just speaks just the truth. Like when you hear interviews with him, it's just like authentically who he is, what he wants to say.
Pulls no punches.
Exactly. I love it.
Yeah. You mentored other people, you know, like a slew of writers and producers and artists. Like, how do you switch hats between being a creative yourself and mentoring other creatives?
I guess I just speak the truth. I just kind of take my experience and try and share it. And people that are assigned to me or around me in any way, I want the best for them, but I also want the best from them. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to just give them as much information and knowledge as I can to help them. And again, try and raise the bar or set the bar really high for them. But mm-hmm. I feel like I've had enough experience in my career, definitely over the last 30 something years, mm-hmm. that I can share that. And I have good, bad, you know, the happy, the ugly. And I take all that and I try and share it with younger writers and younger performers or artists. And even artists that I work with as singers or people that I'm hired to produce, I find myself talking to them and like not even about music. They'll just ask me questions about life and about how to handle certain situations. And I guess that makes me like an elder statesman in the business. But I like that, and I take it seriously, because there's a lot of issues and there's a lot of things that people have to deal with in this business. And I've seen it all. I've been through it all. And if I haven't been through it, somebody that I've worked with, you know, Whitney Houston or Michael Jackson or an Elton John or somebody like that, has definitely been through something that an artist is going through now.
Mm-hmm.
How do you stay grounded when it gets like hectic and disappointing and, mm-hmm. and hard like that?
I try and keep an even keel. I don't get super high. I don't get super low. I have other things in my life that I like to do. I work out, I exercise a ton. And I just have, a disposition that suits this business. I don't get crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I stay grounded because I know this is just fun, and I know I'm very fortunate.
Right.
And I know this is just, we're making art. We're making cool things.
Right.
And so like there's
it's
really
not
no
like war.
Right. There's no, mm-hmm. nobody's going to get sick and die from it. Hopefully we make some people happy from it. And mm-hmm. we get paid to make music, so it's easy to stay grounded. I don't take myself seriously either. I run into so many artists, and I see so many people that are so caught up, and they think they're so important, and they think what they does is the only thing that matters. And I know that the world's a bigger place than that. And it helps that I grew up traveling and reading books and just exposing myself to other things. So
mm-hmm.
I think I stay grounded because I know there's a lot more going on than just me and my little music.
Mm-hmm.
How do you instill that in others that you might mentor? I mean, like, or how could somebody else tap into either the, you know, the competitive spirit of wanting to do better or the groundedness because of, you know, I mean, you've had this opportunity both through sports and through your upbringing to experienced life in a certain way that prepared you for life later on. But totally. A lot of the other people you would sign are, have different lives. They come from different places. They weren't athletes. They, you know, they didn't have a lot of the same experiences or, you know, fortunate, you know, things to overcome, you know, they have their own obstacles.
Well, I take that role really seriously. And I really try and be that person to expose them or give them insight into the way that I like to do things. But I also tell them that the way I do things is not necessarily right for you or right for everybody. You know, everybody has their own mode of operating, and the way I like to do it works for me. It might not work for them, but if you're going to be in my building, you got to adopt some of what I like. Mm-hmm. So I do take it really seriously, and I try and foster a really creative environment in my building, and I try and keep everybody motivated and excited. And I also just teach, because a lot of people, they haven't had a song placed before. And so I teach them. I say, when you place a song, you don't have a party. You don't get excited. You don't go out and buy a piece of jewelry.
Right.
You try and write another song. Right. Like the day you find out you got a song placed, go to the studio and work.
I love that.
You know, but that's cool. Something that nobody really knows if they haven't been through it. Mm-hmm. And the first time you hear your song on the radio, like, appreciate it, enjoy it, be thankful for it, but then drive your butt to the studio and write another song. Because if you get caught up in celebrating a song because you got it placed, your career is going to be over in 6 months.
That's so true. And just like, it's so true, getting caught up in it.
Yeah. And the same for financial things. I see a lot of kids have one hit record. You know, even producers or artists, they have a hit record and they're like the biggest things, and they're all over the internet with all their stuff, and they're bragging and they're talking about how great they are. And I teach everybody that's around me, I said, see that? That's a perfect example of what you don't want to do. Mm-hmm. I said, not only are you going to chop your career in half, but you're going to make other people, if there's any hateful bones in their body, they're going to hate because you're flossing and you're talking about yourself. And the next opportunity they get to step on you, they're going to do it. If you're humble, you're gracious, you're thankful, other people want to be around you. They'll want to help you. They'll want to work with you. And hopefully you'll be able to extend your career. I've seen it go both ways, because I've seen people that people could not wait to push down. They couldn't wait to just jump on top of them. Mm-hmm. Then I've seen other people that were not doing their best work, but they continued to be employed because they were good people. They were honest. They were fair. They were humble. Mm-hmm. People looked to help them out. So I try and teach that.
That's incredible advice. I love that so much.
Well, I'd like to transition to something, because I know that you work out a lot, and I know that you still have that competitive spirit as an athlete, even in music.
Yes.
You know, Sarah and I like to talk about spirituality and having a spiritual practice as a means to balance us so we can connect and be inspired every day. It's something we like to call the daily.
The daily.
So what is your daily routine? You wake up what time?
These jingles though are just so hot.
Hook us up with the burger guy in Tucson.
Yeah, seriously. We need some cash.
You guys can get a quick 1500.
We'll start doing advertisements, sponsorships on the podcast, then we'll write the songs for them.
I love that.
That would be the hottest songwriting jingle duo ever, you two guys.
Pretty amazing. What are some of your daily routines that help you stay connected and creative?
My daily routine is so boring, your listeners are going to be like, this guy's a sleeper. I get up every morning very early, usually 5 o'clock.
And you have young kids? Or
no, my kids are all grown and out of college.
Okay, so you're just chilling then.
So I'm just chilling. Okay. I wake up usually 5 o'clock.
Damn.
Because I can't sleep. My mind gets working, and once I wake up, I'm up. So I stretch every morning for about 45 minutes. And similar to your meditation practice, for me, it's just stretching. I'm not necessarily meditating, but I'm just thinking about myself and thinking about the day, thinking about what I want to do, I spend a lot of time thinking of what I'm grateful for.
Love
and
that.
A little bit of your rose situation. And every day, every morning, I just think, man, I'm so happy about this. I'm so happy about that. I'm so lucky that I have this and that I'm able to do this. And that's what I'm doing while I'm stretching for 45 minutes. Then I go work out. And I usually go to my gym, which I have at my studio. I have a full gym in my studio. Mm-hmm. Or I'll go to a place called Orange Theory, which is a little workout place,
and
do that 2 or 3 days a week.
And what does your workout routine entail?
Every day is different. Every day is a different body part, different exercise. Sometimes
we couldn't keep up, Sarah.
You guys could definitely keep up.
No, you and Jay and Dwayne,
you're
like CrossFit maniacs.
Yeah. Oh, CrossFit?
Yeah, we do a little CrossFit.
Damn.
I also have a Peloton that I've been loving, which is a bike.
Everybody's talking about Peloton.
Yeah, so I've been riding that a couple of days a week.
Do you have like a specific trainer that you like?
I do. I like Jess King. That's my girl, Jess King.
Okay.
She has the best music.
Shout out Jess King.
She's hype. Yeah.
And has it changed over the years? Did you ever do anything?
My routine?
Yeah. Like when you were younger?
Yeah. It's totally changed. It always changed. I never got up this early. I don't know what happened about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I just started waking up.
Even in basketball? Yeah. Like
when I was in college, I obviously had class at like 8 o'clock or whatever. And then we had practice in the evenings. But when I started working music, I would always work super late till 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And then I would sleep till 9 or 10 or 11. But for some reason, no matter what time I go to sleep now, I'm just always up at 5. So that's changed for sure.
Right.
And so, yeah, I work out, whether it's Peloton, CrossFit, Orange Theory. Then I take a shower, go to work, to the studio at 11 o'clock pretty much every day.
Okay.
Usually meet with my administrative team, whoever that may be, whoever's in that day, bookkeeping, business management, my assistant, legal team. I usually do that earlier in the day, 11, 12, 1. Mm-hmm. Then I start talking to the different producers and songwriters in my building, do meetings outside of the studio if I'm going to, you know, a label or, you know, Universal Pictures or somebody like that, do a meeting. And then in the afternoon, 2, 3, 4 o'clock, I start working, programming, producing. Musicians are coming in. Singers are coming in. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do that until I get tired, until I fall asleep.
So you don't have an end time?
No.
You just go until you're done and then you go home?
Yep. I go until I'm too tired to continue.
And what about your food? Like, are you a vegan?
So boring.
I mean, I think it sounds...
Work out and work.
It's a great routine, you know? Some people's are nothing. They're just like, wake up and...
Yeah.
You have to have a routine.
Work. Yeah. Yeah, you have to have a routine.
Okay, well, that's mine.
But what about food? Are you like vegan?
Well, that's exciting because, and I should have said this earlier, but I've always been a healthy eater. I try not to eat carbs. I try not to eat dairy. Mm-hmm. But as of about 3 months ago, I stopped eating chicken as well. And I never ate beef. I didn't get into beef.
Right.
But about 3 months ago, I stopped eating chicken. So now I guess I'm a vegan that eats fish. Pescatarian.
Yeah. I want to stop eating chicken too. And why did you do it? Just for health reasons? Or?
I'll tell you the truth. I went on break over like, I don't know, maybe it was Halloween, and I ate some food for a weekend, and I ate some cake. I think I ate some donuts, just like totally went crazy on my diet. So the following Monday I said, I'm going to go on a cleanse. I'm going to go on a fast, and I'm just going to eat vegetables and juice for a week.
Mm.
So I ate vegetables and I juiced. And then the following week I was like, I feel so good. I had so much energy. I was like healthy. I felt light. Sometimes I'd get groggy in the afternoons and have like an afternoon kind of lull, and I had none of that. And so I said, okay, I'm going to do it for another week. And mm-hmm. so I did it for 2 weeks and I still felt great. And so ever since I've just continued eating that way. Yeah. I added some fish into my diet just I needed more protein.
Yeah.
And when I train a lot, I started losing weight. I lost about 12 pounds, which I did not want to lose at all. I was kind of bummed about that. But so now I'm kind of finding a good balance on my diet.
So how does spirituality tie into your creative process? Are you a God guy? Are you a universe? Do you believe there's something greater than us? Where are you at on that?
I completely believe there's something greater than us because there's got to be to have done all this.
Right.
I'm not a God guy, but I feel like we're part of a much bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what the answer is.
Mm-hmm. And when you're creative, do you feel like it plays into?
No, I don't. Honestly, I don't really concern myself with where it comes from or how it gets there mm-hmm. or what happens. I do operate a lot from just gut instinct in the heart. And mm-hmm. whether you call that, you know, God or spirituality, I kind of just let it happen naturally. But mm-hmm. I think, maybe unlike you guys, I'm also a different type of writer where it sounds a little superficial, but I'm almost like a go to work every day and write guy. And some people are like, I need to feel the moment. I've got to have some intervention or inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's like literally you flip the switch and you start working. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have a hard time with people that they come to my session and they're like, oh, I'm just not feeling it today. I'm not in the mm-hmm. mood or the smell's not right in here. I can't write. And I'm like, I just don't work that way. Like it's time to write a song. Let's write. Let's work. Yeah. It's time to work.
Yeah. I feel the same. I'm with you on that. I'm totally with you on that. I go into the session and I'm like, I can flip right. the switch.
Mm-hmm. I'm not stopping until we write
the
song.
I can flip the switch. And I always think that it's interesting. Listen, there's no wrong way or right way, but there are people who need certain things in order to, like, totally. Lighting has to be right or, yeah. you know, smoke mm-hmm. weed or something. I don't know. Like, yeah. whatever it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, like, I just hear the music that inspires me. I just go.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
It's the music that gets me in the mood. It doesn't matter. Like, if I hear something that I love, I just go for it.
Right.
I feel like I learned how to be like that, to go show up, go to work every day. It's work. You know, I'm showing up and doing it. But I definitely feel like I have those moments where I'm a very, like, I feel very, like, connected at moments, and I'm a vessel, and it's coming through me. And
right.
there's definitely those moments that happen for me, and I'm like, wow, this didn't even feel like I was doing anything.
Yeah. But I feel like if you're not trying, so that I agree with you on that 100%. But I have
that's
to, like,
not every day.
I have to, like, get into it in order to receive that.
Right.
I don't just sit there and wait to receive it. Like,
no, of course.
I'm like, all right, let's write, let's go. And then all of a sudden I say something and I'm like, whoa, did I say that? Like,
yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course.
I think you guys are both more talented than I am in that sense. I'm really a worker. I'm a worker guy. I don't consider myself, like, the most talented songwriter by any stretch of the imagination. I think you guys both, and I know your music, both of you, and I think you guys have written amazing songs, and you probably are channeling something, and you're using your talent to make something amazing. To me, I'm just the guy who knows a little bit of something about music. I can play a few instruments, and I have things in my head that I like. And again, I don't think I have this immense talent. It's just more, I'm work until I figure out what it is in my head that I like, and right. then I can try and figure out how to get it to come out.
Which is an immense talent, by the way. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm definitely talented. I'm thankful for what I can do. But I think when I see guys like you that can come in and just write this amazing song and just poof, it comes out of you, that's just not me.
Right.
I get in there and I work and I figure it out. And if I can't do it, then I find somebody who can. I recruit a couple people. Like, hey, you're great at this. You come over here and let me put this together with this and this and this and then make something.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
We used to have a competition in my studio, again, competition. But we used to have a competition back in the day. We call it 100% Fridays, and we would all have to come into the studio and write 100% songs, like music,
that's cool.
lyric, melody.
I love that.
It. And at that time, it was a crazy cast of people in my studio. It was some of these names you probably don't even remember, but like Tank, the artist, was there, and
of course
Eric Dawkins and Lil Steve Russell and James Fauntleroy.
Well, I feel like I played basketball in the parking lot with all of them.
Yeah,
you sure at the old studio.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. Yeah, and so was that and. Who else was up there? There were so many people there at that point. And anyways, we would all go into the room at the beginning of the day. We'd say, okay, it's 100%, let's go. And then we would all have to come out with songs. And I just remember, I definitely competed pretty well, but it was just always so much work. I'm like, I got to get this music, and then I got to try and come up with the lyric and come up with the melody. Whereas you guys can come in and just like, boom, lyric and melody and stuff is sounding amazing. So I think there is a little bit of a difference there.
I think we should start 100% Fridays again.
I love that. And would you play the songs for each other?
Oh yeah. We'd all sit in the room at the end of the day.
I love that.
Yeah.
We did a camp a couple years ago, and at the end of each day, we would all play the songs for each other, and I love that. What sign are you?
Gemini.
Because I'm Aries and I'm very competitive. I don't know much about Geminis, but
I don't know much about any of them.
My wife's a Gemini. My sister's a Gemini.
Wow, you have a lot of Geminis around you. Yeah.
June 3rd.
Oh,
June my wife's 3rd, June, summer baby.
June 6th.
Okay.
My sister's June 2nd.
That's shout great. Out to the Geminis of the world. So we like to end each episode with something we call
Golden Nuggets.
Golden Nuggets. So Golden Nuggets is where Evan, myself, and our guest, Harvey, are each asked to bring something or recommend something to our listeners, something that inspires you, helps your creative process, quiets your mind, fosters your growth, basically a tool that you utilize in connecting with your creative self. It can be a book, a meditation, a workout, a crystal, a poem, a movie, etc. So mine is this book that is literally has been my Bible for years. When I first read it, I mean, I don't know, I was like 18 when I first read it. It's called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. Mm. I don't know if you've heard of it or read it, but it's break through the blocks and win your inner creative battles. And it just is, it's the best. It just talks about resistance. It talks about kind of what you were talking about, Harvey, like show up, do the work every day, you know, really treat it like it's a job. And I don't know, it just really, really motivated me when I needed it. And it was my Bible for a long time. I would just flip open to a page and read something and it would be like, oh,
flip
yes.
open, read
All
something.
Right, let's see.
No, first thing.
So this says resistance and isolation. Sometimes we balk at embarking on an enterprise because we're afraid of being alone. We feel comfortable with the tribe around us. It makes us nervous going off into the woods on our own. Here's the trick. We're never alone. As soon as we step outside the campfire glow, our muse lights on our shoulder like a butterfly. The act of courage calls forth infallibly that deeper part of ourselves that supports and sustains us. Anyway, then it talks about like John Lennon, Bob Dylan, how basically there's a difference between isolating yourself and being in solitude and sitting with yourself and your thoughts. And I mean, that's just this chapter, but I don't know. It was the most motivating book for me at the time when I needed it. So that's my golden nugget.
I love that.
The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. And I actually wrote, I found Stephen Pressfield on Facebook when I first read it and wrote him a message. And he wrote, and he wrote back and he was like, oh, thank you. You know, this, he's a writer. He writes like.
They probably have it on like audiobook too, or like.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Everywhere.
So great.
And then Amazon or something.
And then he has another book called Turning Pro, which is like the next step, which is like, okay, you want to do this professionally. You got to like wake up at a certain time, sit down at your typewriter, whatever it is. A daily. Exactly.
A daily book. Wow.
Yeah. I'm telling you, this is just the one, this book. So
that's great.
Yeah.
It's good you found it.
Oh my God. I know. It came to me at the perfect time for sure.
My Golden Nugget is a new show. It's weird. It's a new show on Netflix.
Okay.
And it's a strange thing to be a golden nugget, a Netflix show.
Anything can be.
But it's a show called Tidying Up with Marie Kondo.
I just saw that. It's amazing.
It's so amazing. And it inspired me so much over the break.
Yeah.
She, you know, she has this methodology as far as like decluttering your life physically, which becomes kind of emotionally and spiritually as, you know, I don't think she like fully intends. She probably intends it, but it's not like where her entry point is. It's all about like getting rid of the actual literal clutter in your life. Mm-hmm. But for me, I did that. I spent some time doing it. And the whole idea of like getting rid of things that don't bring you joy in your life.
Yeah. Her whole thing is what sparks joy.
What sparks joy, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I was thinking about it across my whole life over the last few weeks. Like what people in my life, what things in work, which people I like to write with, like what sparks joy in my life. And I feel like if you move the things out of your life, what I picked up from this show is if you move the things out of your life that don't bring you joy, you open up room to receive things that do bring you joy. Mm. And you may not know things that bring you more joy yet, but if you're holding on to the things that you're unsure bring you joy, you for sure as hell aren't going to have the room to even see that. The opportunity won't even present itself to you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I actually watched this show, which is a very like cute, endearing show and kind of at sometimes sad and depressing. There's some of the people she talks to who are, you know, borderline hoarders. But also it inspired me to like kind of like do a deep cleansing of my house and of my things. But at the same time, it inspired me. I took it one step further and I thought, you know what? I want to do that on like a daily basis. I want this to be my golden nugget, you know, for 2019 is I want to judge what I let in my life and what I let surround me by, whether it brings me joy, whether it's a person or a way of writing songs or even just a creative process or a daily routine or anything. Like if I don't feel joy doing it, I'm just not going to do it.
I love that.
And so the show is very cute and endearing, and it's also inspirational, and it's on Netflix. So you should check it out.
I love it.
Love it. You know, what's funny, Evan, is I don't know at what age it happens, but that clicked over for me for sure a few years ago, just naturally, because I think you start seeing the end of your time and you say, I don't want to waste my time doing things that I don't love doing. And I definitely don't want to be around people that I don't like.
Right.
So for me, it's definitely a practice that I've been involved in for a few years. Like, and sometimes you come off a little bit selfish because you're like, you know, I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to do that. But I think you found it, and you found it in the form of a TV show, but definitely a great way to live your life. Do the things that make you happy. Don't do the things that don't make you happy.
Right.
Great. Absolutely.
It's hard to do though, because sometimes is. There's obligations and there's things you feel responsible for.
Like, how do you know? Like, are you just doing? Are you just like shirking something off because you don't want to do it?
Right.
You can't just be like, I'm not paying my bills. They don't make me happy.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a fine line there.
Right.
And
right.
Especially if you're like a caretaker, I feel like I'm very much of a caretaker, and I've had to learn to say no.
Yeah.
You know, and say, I don't really want to do this. I'm not going to do this.
I'm literally walking into rooms in my house and I'm like, I love this room now. I got rid of so much stuff in this room, right? And that's how I feel inside too, about having made some decisions in business over the holidays. I'm not going to continue doing this. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go into business with this person. I'm not going to work with this writer, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And I already feel lighter because of it.
It's liberating.
It's liberating.
Yeah.
So great.
Self-love, really.
Good work, Evan.
Harvey, your golden nugget.
My golden nugget is hard to explain. You guys, what you draw inspiration from, I guess, is kind of what you're defining as a golden nugget, right?
Yeah, something that just,
so I'll try and explain my golden nugget, but it is a bigger concept. For me, it's excellence in art is my golden nugget, and I'll explain that.
Okay.
I try and surround myself with excellence in art in every form, because I find that it really inspires me and excites me to do what I try and do with my art. Mm-hmm. So I read a ton of books. And most of the books that I read are biographies, to be honest, and they're about excellent people.
I love that.
About people who have accomplished something amazing in any field. I don't care what it is. So a couple of the books that I love, the Steve Jobs biography is an amazing biography. On the Shoulders of Giants is another great story written by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Mm. The John Wooden book is an amazing book. But my favorite biography of all times is the biography of Quincy Jones, the autobiography of Quincy Jones. It's called Q. So anybody who is anywhere close to the entertainment industry has to read that book.
Okay.
So that's my world in books. Mm-hmm. I do the same thing in music. I find excellence in all genres of music. Kinda Blue by Miles Davis, or Amazing Grace by Aretha Franklin. Records like that were created in a time when we didn't have the technology that we have or the ease at which we can make records. Mm-hmm. And the quality that they made and the songwriting, the vocal performance and the musical performances, even as recent as like a Michael Jackson record, Off the Wall or Bad,
sure. You know,
listening to those records from top to bottom, reading a biography about somebody who did something amazing, watching a film about somebody who did, Walked the Line, Johnny Cash, that movie. Seeing things like that, and seeing a Basquiat painting or seeing a painting by an artist that you really, really, really love, those are my golden nuggets. And I guess my general golden nugget is surround yourself with inspiring and amazing art that other people have done and ingest it into your database. And then hopefully it will be something you can pull out when you need to create something. And that's what I try to do. And that's what I love to do.
I'm like so inspired right now.
Yeah, I love that. I
haven't read Quincy's autobiography.
Me neither.
Is it just ridiculous?
It's a must read. You have to read it. I have read it 7 times.
Wow.
And I write.
Do you get something new out of it each time?
Yeah, because it inspires me and refuels me every time. And I write on the book each time I've read it, and I date it and I sign it, and just so I can keep record of it. And Quincy signed my Quincy book, which is even crazier. But it's just a book that shows you what other people have accomplished, and it opens your eyes and your possibilities to great things that can be done. And that's why I think my nugget is surrounding myself with incredible and amazing art, because you see other people and the things that they've done, and it makes it available to us. Mm-hmm. And it makes it like, okay, well, they did that. I want to do this. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I love to do.
I feel like I know some people who get like, I think that swallows them up sometimes, you know, they feel like, oh man, like
I'll never do that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. I love it. I'm so excited about it. When I read Steve Jobs' book and I see what he did, like he came up with something that nobody even heard of really, like computers, mm-hmm. and then he took it to cell phones, then he took it to animation, then he took it, like he revolutionized 10 businesses. Mm-hmm. That's amazing and exciting and inspirational to me. And
totally.
It just makes me hyped.
Mm-hmm.
Totally off topic, but just about Steve Jobs for a second. I always thought it was so interesting in that book how innovative he was and how right he was about so many things. Mm-hmm. And he thought because he was a fruitarian that he didn't have to wear deodorant. So I always thought that to be the weirdest
What's
thing ever.
What's a fruitarian?
That, like he all only he ate fruit. And so he didn't think he had to wear deodorant and his body odor was terrible.
Did he have a reason for only eating fruit?
He just thought that if he only ate fruit, then he wouldn't have body odor. And he was wrong. And what? He couldn't smell it because he was nose deaf.
So bizarre.
But I just thought it's so interesting. He's so smart and then so wrong over here.
That's we felt the so same strange. Thing about his treatment of cancer. He felt like he
right,
could
true.
Cure his own cancer.
True.
But to have the kind of belief and self, like empowered feeling that he had, mm-hmm. to me, that's amazing. And I think if you look through a lot of history and a lot of great artists in any field, they've had an ability to stick to their guns. Another yeah. biography I didn't mention was George Lucas. If you read his biography, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. This guy made Star Wars when these type of movies weren't being made, and he self-financed the part of it because he believed in it so wholeheartedly. He put his own money on the table. The studio said, we're not paying for that. He said, okay, I'll pay the last $2 or $3 million. In exchange, I want the merchandising rights for Star Wars.
Damn.
And they said, fine, the merchandising rights is not worth anything.
I love that.
And so those are the kind of things to me that are amazing and that inspire yeah. and excite me to think like I want to do something great.
I love that. Yeah. I just saw Lady Gaga's show in Vegas and I never really was like the biggest fan until recently A Star Is Born. I was just sort of won over and I just miss pop music in that way, so I started listening to her records anyway. But seeing her perform was just so inspiring to me because she just like bleeds for her art and her music and from everything from dancing to singing to playing, all of it.
She goes in
and seeing that show, I was like, holy shit. And it made me feel like I want to fucking do more shit, you know, like I want to fulfill all my dreams. And it was so inspiring.
Yeah.
And yeah, I love that mentality of just surrounding yourself with the most excellent art.
Yeah. You know, what's been interesting in my career is being able to really get a bird's eye view of all the people that have done really incredible things and seeing what the commonalities are between them. And I think, as you said, Lady Gaga has something that I've seen in a lot of these amazing, legendary, iconic performers, which is they don't care about anything else. All they care about is their art and their careers and their music and their fans and making great music.
Yeah.
And a lot of other areas in their lives have suffered because of it. And that's why you find so many of these people are so troubled and they have so many issues, because they don't care about any of that. All they care about is excellence in their work and what they're doing. And there's been some byproducts of that. And like sometimes it's drug abuse or social misbehavior, whatever it is, but it's all a result of them caring so much about making this music and making this art. And I love that about people like Lady Gaga I tell everybody that I come in contact with that are up and coming musicians or songwriters or producers or artists even, I said, if you have anything else in life that you love to do or you like to do slightly better than music, or even if you like anything else at all, you should do that. Because if you don't love music more than anything, mm-hmm. and if you don't wake up every day dying, literally dying to do it, mm-hmm. you're not going to win. Mm-hmm. You're just not going to. It's too competitive. There's too many great people.
Yeah.
And you're going to fall by the wayside.
And talent sometimes is just not enough, you know?
It's not enough. There's a few people that can get by on talent, but mm-hmm. it really takes a ton of work, and yeah. it takes a ton of being knocked down and getting back up and mm-hmm. being persistent.
Something, I don't know if it was in this book or not, but I read something like 99 failures for your one success. Like you just get knocked down, and then you're up, and then you're down again, and then it's just that continuing sort of...
Is that a Chumbawamba song that you were singing?
Kind of, actually, yeah.
Well, is that Tub Thumper?
Yeah, it's the sentiment of that song, yes.
Well, the name of my new label and company is actually called 100 Up, and it comes from that philosophy, which is...
Oh, I love that.
If you get knocked down 99 times, you just have to get up 100.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so good segue.
What are the odds of that,
Thank you for the plug.
That was amazing.
That's super dope.
I'm so inspired by everything you had to say, Harvey. I know that you...
Me too.
You downplay that, but like, I feel like your work ethic and your connection to your creativity is super inspiring.
Well, thank you. Thank you guys very much. I feel good to have been able to share some of it with you. And I'm a huge fan of both of your work and your careers. And you're also cool people. So this is good stuff.
Yeah. Thank you. You too. And
thanks for being our guest and letting us into your creative process. Where can everyone find you online if they want to follow what you're up to?
Best place is probably either my website, harveymasonmedia.com, or my social medias, which is just Harvey Mason Jr., Twitter and Instagram.
And you can find us at writetothesource.com or on our Instagram at writetothesource. We'll have all of our guests' daily routines and golden nuggets up on our sites if you want to check them out and see if they inspire you. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through our website or any platform you listen to podcasts on. And don't forget to rate us and vote us up.
Harvey, thank you so much for being our incredible guest today.
Thanks, you guys. Right to the source. I love it.
So one last thing. I read tarot cards.
Oh, nice.
And I always pull a card for our guest. And it's funny because I don't really know you. I mean, we know each other through the Grammy board and just like music and everything, but we don't know each other very well. But for some reason, this card just felt like the card. And after talking to you tonight, I was like, damn, I'm pretty good at this. But this card is the Hierophant. And this card is all about authenticity and truth. And, you know, he's sitting in his throne with, you know, his team below him. He's running his life, his business, his truth. And he's just connected to who he is and his authentic self and his truth. And I feel that so strongly about you. And even just having this conversation, you really just are speaking from the heart, and it feels very authentic and lovely. And so,
well, thank you, Sarah. It makes me feel good. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And that's your card that I pulled for you.
I love that.
So thank you for being here. Thanks everyone for tuning in. And don't forget, when you're being creative and you want to connect,
let it go and let's go right to the source. We create a mental atmosphere.
Right to the source.